Afternoon, everyone. I'm Lee Svensson. I'm National Co-Convener of Emily's List. I'd like to ask Pamela to come up and do an acknowledgement of country before we start.
Tēnā gātā, Pamela, yora yora, gana kanai winya. Hello, my name is Pamela, I'm a yora yora and gana kanai woman. We, Emily's List Australia, wish to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands which we are meeting on today. We're coming today from the Wurundjeri and the Bunurong people of the Kulin Nation's lands. We pay our respects to elders past, present and future, and we acknowledge the continuing rich culture and connection to the land of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And we pay our respects to the First Nations women especially, and acknowledge their special contribution that they make to community and for future generations. We also acknowledge that this land was not ceded and always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Thank you. It's my job to give you a little bit of her story for Emily's for the past 25, going on 26 years. For those, I think most of you are probably aware of this, but we actually have discovered we need to start with the advice that Emily stands for: early money is like yeast, it makes the dough rise. Because too many people no longer remember that. So Emily's in Australia started in 96. It had taken about 4 years from the let's do this to the start. Leonie Morgan, who's here with us today, started the conversation bringing along Joan Kerner, Kay Setches, Candy Broad and many others to build the support for Emily's to become a functioning reality. In 94, the initial ALP AA rules for a 35% women in winnable seats by 20 by 2002, I nearly said 2022, saw women's selection go backwards, which really was not what we wanted at all. And it was clear that a target alone, even in the rules, was insufficient and more needed to be done. Our wonderful foresighted women chose the vehicle of Emily's List. They also ensured Emily's was established and remains outside the ALP. Once the boys indicated they would direct the allocation of funds, the decision was, of course, inevitable. Their vision was for an organisation run by and for women, one that functioned on feminist community organising principles. The goals were simple: elect more women to all parliaments in all houses in Australia. The women who we support are committed to the Emily's principles: equity, diversity, choice, equal pay, and early childhood education and care. Endorsed candidates sign a pledge to support and foster these goals once elected. Thus far, Emily's has achieved the election of more than 300 women to our parliaments since starting in 96. In the recent federal election, we have new members from New South Wales, Sally Sitto for Reid. In the Northern Territory, Marion Skimgail for Lingari. She's the first First Nations woman to hold that seat, which is pretty wonderful. Louise Miller-Frost for Boothby in South Australia. In Victoria, Karina Garland in Chisholm and Michelle Ananda Raja in Higgins, the first ALP person to hold Higgins. And in West Australia, Tanya Lawrence in Hasluck, Tracy Roberts in Pierce, Zanita Mascarenhas in Swan, and Fatima Payman in the Senate. And she is the first Muslim woman to hold a Senate seat there. We have increased not just our numbers of women, but our diversity massively, which is really exciting. But this wasn't our only aim, and nor are they the reflection of our only success. Women are a serious force in Australian politics, and if we needed any proof of that, not just the independents, but the numbers of women who voted Labor and Greens are a reflection of our power as women in the context of Australia now. The diversity of our federal representation is now starting to represent the Australia we live in. Still too white, but we have many more races, colours, and religions. And as an atheist, I was delighted that two new ministers took the oath on the Quran and others made an affirmation. I think that that goes to starting to show more of our diversity, and I think that's fabulous as well. The ALP members of the House and the Senate are now 50% women. Sadly, the new ministry is only 43%. We're going to have to get there a bit more, but 50% women in the two houses in federally. We have the first ever First Nations woman sworn in as the Minister for Indigenous Affairs. And we have the first Muslim minister and assistant minister. And all of those things are part of what we as an organisation started and support. Early childhood education and care, followed by aged care, are two of the most important issues for Australia and significant major commitments by the ALP. The announcement by Vic and New South Wales show that even the Conservatives, some of them, recognise the importance of ECEC. A woman's issue now at the forefront of political thinking and funding is fundamental to getting elected. The ALP is committed to removing barriers to equal pay in the IR system, and this includes both a pay equity panel and making equal pay an objective of the Act, which it currently isn't, and also a care sector panel, which is about the low paid areas, ECEC, aged care, disability care, even healthcare across the board, because those sectors are having a lot of difficulty under the current structures. All sectors that are government funded have different rules, really, when it comes to managing within the current IR system. EL is the force behind these changes, make no mistake about it. Our endorsed candidates have initiated and supported these changes. Availability of abortions will be part of the public health funding negotiations in the next round, with a view to making access a reality instead of just the technicality that it is now, even though it's now available in every jurisdiction and safe access zones exist near every clinic in Australia. While Emily's remains our tagline, we as an organisation must move to other methods of support, particularly here in Victoria, where we are limited to providing now $4,200 over the four-year cycle to all our candidates, because we have a pack of idiots in terms of what election funding means. So we need to start the conversation internally about what and where we move in providing support. And so some of our support is now moving to other things. So over the past year, like everybody else, we realised video conferencing has some benefits well beyond the pandemic, which is good because I didn't like it much. Did anyone? And we have commenced attempting to mobilise our sisters in obvious ways to assist our candidates using our next election for our groundwork in kind of, I suppose, our pilot project, if you like, for this. Getting feet on the ground, attendance at fundraisers and direct donations, and making sure that actually is recognised as being Emily's work as well. Because money from for Victorian candidates is barely an option now. We already provide mentoring, a fabulous mentoring system headed up by Leonie, and Anne in Queensland, and training for our candidates and potential candidates, of which this session is but one example. I'd like now to introduce our speakers. I'll start this in with the fabulous Claire Moore. Claire was an ALP Senator for Queensland from 2002 to 2019, having been elected in the 2001 federal election. In the Senate, she served as Chair or Deputy Chair of the Community Affairs Committee since July 2005, including both Chair of the Community Affairs Legislation Committee and Deputy Chair of the Community Affairs References Committee. She also served as a member of the Joint Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade, as a member of the Senate Standing Committee on Regulations and Ordinances, and as the chair of the Parliamentary Group on Population and Development. Claire served as a Shadow Minister for Women, Shadow Minister for Carers, Shadow Minister for Communities, and the Manager of Opposition Business in the Senate. Immediately prior to entering Parliament, she was the Queensland Secretary of the CPSU from 1994 to 2001 and a public servant. Earlier, Claire worked as a public servant in the Department of Aboriginal Affairs and the Department of Social Security, which is now Senelec, 1980 to 1994. From 1996 to 2001, she was Vice President, Chair of the Women's Committee and Chair of the Arts Committee of the Queensland Council of Unions. She's also a keen member and supporter of AFIDA, the Trade Union Overseas Aid Program, which is fabulous for anyone who doesn't know it. Claire has been involved in many community organisations, including Australians for Native Title and Reconciliation, the Australian Republican Movement, Friends of the ABC, and the Australian Workers Heritage Centre. She joined Emily's List as a founding member in 1996 through Molly Robinson in Queensland, and had the real joy of working with Joan Leone and so many wonderful Emily's women over the years. She's been a fabulous example of what Emily's women are and do.
And a great mentor.
And a fabulous mentor. Thank you, Leone. Claire, more.
Thank you.
Next to her is our wonderful Leone, and if my that's right, thank you very much, Leone Morgan. Leone came up with the idea of Emily's List in 92 and was a founding member. Shit, Sherlock. She also developed and continues to coordinate the Emily's List mentoring program. Leone works across Australia and the Asia Pacific to encourage women into politics. She holds a Master of Education, postgraduate qualifications in media and women's studies, and is a graduate member of the Australian Institute of Company Directors. She joined the board at Holmes Glen in July 2016, where she is a member of the board's People, Culture and Remuneration Committee and Audit Committee. In 2017, she was made a member of the Order of Australia for her work towards equitable representation of women in politics. Leone has worked across the Australian private, public and community sectors. She currently consults in leadership, workforce development, governance and mentoring. Leone has worked in education, media and government, and is an experienced company director and committee member. She is currently a director of Film Victoria and is a co-opted member of Emily's List Australia National Committee. Thank you, Leone. And Hutch, our Hutch, currently works at the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence, undertaking advocacy to government on behalf of and with disadvantaged communities. Over the past 20 years, she's worked in senior management roles as well as in social worker roles involving at-risk young people and family violence victims. Hutch has also worked for nearly 4 years as a ministerial policy advisor during the BRACS government in the education and women's affairs portfolios. Hutch is a former EL Victorian ELAG co-convener, national committee member, and succeeded Joan Kerner as the national co-convener in 2006. As an ALP member for nearly 30 years, she has participated in various policy committees and previously held the roles of Victorian Labor Women's Network co-convener and was the first person of an ethnic background to serve as Victorian ALP State President, where she led the introduction of the first sexual harassment, bullying, discrimination and misconduct policy to govern conduct between ALP branch members, which was the predecessor of all of the Australian bullying harassment policies across ALP policies across Australia. She is currently serving on the executive of the Corangamite FEA, which involves fundraising for the previously federal marginal seat of Corangamite. She's doing best to raise her two sons, I'll be those two at the back, as progressive and bilingual boys as her contribution to her two favourite isms, feminism and multiculturalism. Thanks, Hutch. And lastly, the moderator for our panel today, Pamela Anderson. Pamela is a proud First Nations woman with ancestors from Yorta Yorta and Gunai Kunai mobs. She has 20 years' experience in the financial services sector, working within various roles in mid-size and large corporations. In 2013, she successfully completed the AMP Horizons program. In 2016, she became the principal of her own financial planning business and is currently the director of Adicot Partners. Pamela has formal qualifications in marketing and communications, a graduate diploma in financial services, has successfully passed the FASEA exam in 2020, she can tell you what that means, and is currently completing a Bachelor of Law at Deakin Uni. Pamela is a passionate and dedicated member of the ALP. She is the current secretary of the Vic Economic and Innovation Policy Committee and a general member of the Vic Women's Affairs Policy Committee. President of the Roeville State Branch and was recently the campaign manager for the federal seat of Aston for the last election. She's an active member and advocate of AIOFP, again, she can tell you what that means, and the FSU, which is the Financial Services Union, because I know that. Pamela is a member of Emily's List Australia. She joined the National Committee in, she better be, in 2018 and has held, I've checked it actually. I've never trusted anyone. Has a senior position as an, she had a senior position as National Treasurer and co-convener of the Victorian ELAG. In April this year, she was appointed as the CEO of Emily's List to replace her fabulous Marie. Pamela and her husband have two young daughters, one of which is here today, somewhere over the back there, and enjoy spending time together as a family whenever the spare time, whatever spare time they may have. Thanks, Pamela. And I'll leave it to you from here.
Thank you so much, Lee. And yes, to some of the women on the panel, I did beef up your bios because you're far more impressive than just one or two sentences. So, first off, I think the best question to start with is, how did you get involved with Emily's List? I'm actually going to start with the person who had the idea, Leonie.
Thank you. Well, I think you've heard a little bit about it, but just why I started thinking about Emily's List was because when the kids, some of you will remember the Kennett government.
Yes,
when the Kennett government took over from the Kerner government, Jones government, I went into the parliament and I looked around and I saw there were very, very few women in the parliament. Hardly any women were left in the parliament because women were only ever pre-selected for marginal seats. And so when government changed, all the women went. And that really shocked me because I've been a member of the ALP, but I hadn't thought about that before. So I started to think about what we could do. And one of the things that I thought about and I'd seen was Emily's List in the US, which is a Democrat organisation, pro-choice. And I thought, this is something that could work here. So in short form, I went around trying to persuade people. When I met with Joan Kerner, who's a fantastic mentor to me, when I met with Joan was really sensible. And Joan said to me, look, Leonie, you can give women all the training you can do. You can give them all the support you can do, but if they don't get the seats, then there's a problem. So what we need to do is have something like Emily's List, but we also need to get the numbers. So importantly, at the same time as we worked on Emily's List, to give women mentoring, support, training, money, we also worked in the party to on the affirmative action rule change. Both those things are really important to seeing women elected, and that's why you're here today, because you want to know about getting elected. Both those things are important in seeing women getting elected. And we can so easily lose the numbers. We look like we're doing well at the moment, but we can so easily lose it, as we can see in the States with all the challenges around Roe versus Wade. So that's why we have to keep our eye on the ball, and Emily's and AA is so important.
That's absolutely perfect, Leonie. I'll go to Claire, please, if you could.
I first heard of Emily's List at the Women, Power and Politics conference that was the centenary of the right to vote for women in South Australia, which was an extraordinary event. And we had speakers from all around the world. What had happened was it had been planned by the Labor government. Labor went out of power, but the Liberal government picked up on it and worked cooperatively with the Labor women who'd set it up, two of whom were our foundation members, Carolyn and...
Anne Levy.
And Anne Levy. They had been deeply involved in that process. So I heard about it then, and I'm not quite sure how I fell into it. I still can't remember exactly how it happened. I pinch myself because I actually found myself over the next couple of years at a couple of events, including a Labor Women's Conference in Perth, where my friend Molly Robson, who's an extraordinary woman who was very, very close with Joan, Molly was picking up on the concept, and I remember being in a bus. I remember being in a bus which was travelling back from a winery, and I was the only non-drinker on the bus. But in that bus was Carmen Lyons, Joan Kerner, Kay Sedgers, Judy Spence, and all these wonderful women. And they sat in that bus and they talked about how they'd get Emily's List going. And I was kind of there. And no one actually said, who are you or why are you here? They just kind of surrounded you, and you were just surrounded with passion and love and respect, and those three things I think are so important to the organisation. And I was blessed, right place, right time, having no intention of being a politician. I had worked on other people's campaigns. I was a trade unionist. I was there with the CPSU, Community Public Sector Union, and it just went from there, and it was just extraordinary. But once you're in, you can't get out. And that's the issue. Once you're in, you are so caught up in just why what we do is important, which Leonie has explained. And my view is that once you're in and you see the difference you make and you see the range of women, and for me, the reason I'm in it are the photographs that you see. And I was standing there with my niece, Kate, and remembering faces and times that are part of my history. But it's part of our history.
That's awesome. Thank you, Claire. And I totally want a bus. I can see a bus and a winery in our very near future.
It works.
Hutch, can you tell us how you got involved in Emily's?
Sure. I was a student at uni and I was involved in Young Labor, and I'd had some really frustrating experiences in the Labor Party where I had sought to be a youth conference delegate and had been bullied. Or tried to be bullied into withdrawing my nomination from being a youth conference delegate because someone else had wanted to control the numbers. And so I'd had these kind of futile attempts of engaging with the Labor Party where I was doing certain things, but I wasn't seeing the outcome of those things, or I was having negative experiences. And so I was really, someone had told me, another friend from uni had gone along to an Emily's List meeting and asked me to kind of come along. And it was in the lead up to the 99 election where Kennett was evicted, and I got involved in Liz Beattie's campaign, and she was running to get rid of Bernie Finn at the time. Mm. And so I got involved in that campaign and was letterboxing, and I distinctly remember the day where I went to put one of Liz Beattie's brochures in the letterbox, and there was a picture of a fetus on a Bernie Finn brochure, basically accusing Liz Beattie of being pro-choice, and which he tried to equate to wanting abortion at birth. And I was just outraged by, you know, him being so anti-choice. And an opportunity to be part of that campaign and to get to know how campaigns work was part of that contagious experience of being exposed to a tangible impact, because Liz went on to beat Bernie Finn, who unfortunately came back into the parliament and will hopefully lose at the next election. But then seeing the decimation of the Kennett government in that. So it was about putting effort in and seeing the tangible outcome of being involved in the election of a progressive woman to replace a regressive male. And so that together with what Claire's just alluded to, which was the feminist mentoring and organising that I witnessed and being able to, you know, meet people like Leonie and Kay and Joan and have exposure to that mentoring and support was just really inclusive and contagious in terms of wanting to be part of. And, you know, like Claire said, you get roped in and it's like a cult. You know, you never leave.
You don't.
And so suddenly one day you're national co-convener, and, you know, with Claire. So, yeah, that's how I got involved.
That's absolutely awesome, and it is a very it's so welcoming.
It's a welcoming cult.
You find, I think for me, I think I found my people.
Yeah.
As soon as that's the first thing that dawned on me when I first went to an Emily's meeting, I went, oh my gosh, I found my people. So not only are we talking about the election, but also about going into parliament or getting elected. It's also about leadership. So can you briefly share your stories? And each of you are leaders in your own rights, and you have Claire's also already been in parliament. So could you please share your story as how you got to the leadership role that you were in?
Again, it was not planned. in my pre-selection was one of those things, you know, we've heard about how things can be tough in the party, and we've all shared those stories, but I was originally pre-selected for the unwinnable, then it still is for Labor, the unwinnable number 3 seat in the Senate, because I was a woman, I was breathing, I'm involved in a whole range of community organisations, so that was the unwinnable one, and it was the left turn, so I was put in that. Through circumstances completely outside me, which were internal fights in the parliament, it went from unwinnable number 3 to winnable number 2. And that created a bit of a stir that suddenly this unknown woman, unknown in some places, woman from an unaffiliated union was now in a position that there could be a winnable position. And I remember I was very stressed by this and I didn't know whether I should stay, and Molly Robson and Joan Kerner rang me up and said, and my very, very closest friend, who is a strong, strong woman in Queensland, a trade union, is called Janice Mays. Janice was more direct. She said, keep your mouth shut and let it happen. I'll do the numbers. And that was how Janice. But Joan just said, you know, this is what happens. You have a moment, and unless you take that moment and you work with it, it won't come around again. And that was how it started. So it wasn't me planning to be there, but it was fabulous. I mean, the job that I was meant to do, the Senate, in terms of community work, committee work, working on policy, it was like, you know, you found your people. I found the spot. But my advice about how it happens and how you keep it is find your team. I don't think leadership is a single person assessment. You need to be part of a team, and a team you trust, and a team whose values you share, and who will tell you when you're stuffing up. I keep saying this over and over, you do not surround yourself with people who will say to you that you're great. You need to have people that you respect and that will keep you grounded and make you continually looking at how you can be better. And I think the whole idea of leadership for me is team. And that is also how I think Emily's List operates. And what I found through just about every decision that I had to make and around policy and about bringing people on is you work with your team. And Emily's List has always been my team.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Claire. Leonie, you've got the mic.
yes. Leadership's an interesting thing to talk about because I never thought of myself as a leader. You know, I came from a working class background and I was first in my family to university when I was older, after I'd been married and divorced, and I never ever thought of myself as a leader. Then I met Joan, and Joan was such a fantastic mentor and supporter that she made me start to think that maybe I am a bit of a leader. But still, I kind of didn't believe it. Now, you know, you've been in Parliament, and our job in Emily's List is to support women in Parliament. And at one stage, I thought I might go into Parliament. I was keen to go into Parliament when I was in my 40s. And I had a lot of support. and I could have got there. I had. It's really important when you want to get elected, you've got to have your supporters, you've got to have your mentors and your sponsors, people that are going to talk about you, people that can get you the numbers. Key if you want to get into Parliament, if you want to get elected. So I had those people around me, powerful people who could do it. And then I started thinking about me, and I realised that when it comes to about 8:30 at a branch meeting, and Helen, you've not, because I'm such a slacker in our branch, I don't go that much, but when it comes to about 8:30 at night, I get really tired and I get really irritable with people. If you want to go into Parliament, you've got to be someone that's nice to people, patient with people, and also wants to do late nights, because that's what it's all about, doing those late nights. So I realised at that stage in my 40s that I would never want to go into Parliament. And I thought to myself, but what do I want to do? And I knew my passion was getting women elected. So I took a different track and I focused on Emily's List and other work I've done with women in local government and women in the Asia Pacific region around getting women elected. But I still didn't think of myself as a leader. But what changed for me was when I got my Order of Australia, you know, because I thought people believed that I was a leader. And I was able to think really strongly of myself as a leader then when I had that Order of Australia. So I think it's leadership's a funny thing, and you often, like Claire says, you really need your team, and you can't be a leader without followers. And it's very hard sometimes to think of yourself as a leader. But there are women here like Susan there, Susan Davies, who's been in Parliament, or Lucy O'Brien, who's just a fantastic, you know, leader. You know, there's women here, Marie, who's not in the room at the moment. Oh, you are, Marie overall. There's women like you that are often quiet but amazing, amazing leaders. So all of you, think of yourself as a leader.
Not everyone has the same self-knowledge, if you look at the description, as you have said, because a lot of people get those petitions that aren't.
No, they aren't.
And patient.
Go ahead.
I too was the first in my family to go to university, many years later. and I was working as a social worker and had the opportunity to apply for a job as a ministerial advisor with Mary Dale Hunty. And, you know, I was someone who always thought you should have a lot of life experience before you go into advisor jobs. And I remember Joan having a chat to me about, you know, there might not be a Labor government for another, 5 or 10 years at the end of this one. And so, you know, and so she spoke to me about the importance of taking up opportunities and saying yes, and then working out later how you would do it, and kind of, you know, not being so principled about thinking you need to have done X before you do Y. You know, men often just grab opportunities and, you know, without kind of feeling that other people would judge them or like. So I guess that was my first opportunity, and I had the opportunity for nearly 4 years to see how government worked from the inside, and that's been really helpful when I went back into the non-government sector and have worked as, you know, social worker and management positions in the NGO sector. And obviously had time out to have my two boys, and then I had the opportunity, and I'd always, you know, in terms of working within Emily's List, encourage a lot of other women to take up leadership positions, and also wanted Emily's List not to just be about supporting progressive Labor women in terms of the values we've talked about, but I wanted us to increase the diversity, and which we're doing really now. And so when the opportunity presented for being ALP state president, and I looked up on the board and all the names of other people who'd been ALP state president, and there'd only been 5 other women in our 118-year history at that time, and all of those were white women, and a lot of them who I'd admired, and Joan Kerner was one of them, and Sharon Burrow, etc. And it really struck me that I'd been encouraging a lot of other women to, you know, step forward when leadership opportunities came forward, and I couldn't now, having, you know, been presented with that opportunity, say no myself. And so, and I was really conscious that, you know, there was other, you know, women of Muslim background, other women who were lesbians, other women from ethnic backgrounds who hadn't seen a woman in that leadership position. And I know there was a lot of women who came up to me afterwards and, you know, that notion of you can't be what you can't see. And so I've really been conscious of my responsibility as a leader to step up to the same opportunities that I've encouraged other women to do. And so that was a really great opportunity to see how the party worked from the inside. and take the opportunity when, you know, there was a big crisis in our parliaments in terms of lack of sexual harassment procedure and support. And it was really about taking that opportunity when you're in a leadership position, you know, and for me, leadership has never been about, you know, warming a seat or, you know, about status. For me, it's really about making it better for, you know, particularly women in the party and other disadvantaged people, but making it better once I left that position. And so when the opportunity presented to kind of, you know, drive the process, and I did it with a lot of other women because leadership, especially in the ARP, you've got to really bring people with you, and it needs to be cross-factional and, you know, really show that support. And the time had come, you know, it was on the cusp of the Me Too movement where you weren't going to get the dinosaurs in the party saying, oh, we shouldn't have this because this is going to be restrictive in any sense. There was no opposition whatsoever, but it needed, you know, a bipartisan group of men and women who wanted to put that forward. And so it was a great opportunity. We were Victoria was the first branch to actually... So we obviously had a sexual harassment policy that... for our staff, but we hadn't had one which governed conduct. And I had two young women who'd come to see me. You know, one of them had been raped, one of them had been sexually harassed, and, you know, they knew other women in that situation, and they were leaving the party. And what I wanted to reverse was a situation where instead of the women leaving the party, it was actually the men who were the perpetrators leaving the party. And so by the end of my term, there were 11 cases that I'd overseen, and we had the opportunity for one male to leave the party, and he saw himself as a future MP. You know, he saw himself in terms of abusing women as and kind of blackmailing them as, you know, and obviously he'd had mentors in that way himself. But, you know, if we hadn't had something like that in place, it gave me the opportunity to see that he saw his trajectory and we would have lost the talents and efforts of women in the party. And so sometimes it can be as simple as a policy. It doesn't need to be as big and stage, you know, in terms of what people do in Parliament, etc. But really making it a better place and a more inclusive party.
Thank you so much. And that is such powerful, powerful ideas there. So team, policy, it can sometimes be the absolute leadership. And, of course, you know, believing in yourself. And I think that's something that we've all got to do is actually believe in ourselves and realise that we are actually leaders. We're leaders in our own homes, our communities, our jobs. We're leaders everywhere. So my next question is, Joan believed that people who were affected by decisions should be part of making them. We know that's one of her core and common beliefs. What impact does more women getting elected have in terms of policy change and law reform for Australian women? I'm going to start with you this time, Arch.
I've had the privilege of working with Leonie on gender gap research, and that is we do focus groups with women in marginal seats and hear what they want, and we get an opportunity to translate that into policy recommendations. And so I've had the privilege of briefing John Brumby and Steve Brax when they were Premier, and Julia Gillard when she was Prime Minister, in terms of sharing what do we kind of see as ideas. And one of the crucial ones was paid maternity leave. And that was an idea whose time had come. So, you know, I remember my sister, who's a teacher, being outraged when her peers were starting to get pregnant. And so she knew she was eligible for paid maternity leave, but a couple of her friends were in the private sector and she had no idea that, you know, not everyone automatically got paid maternity leave, and she knew that I was involved in policy. She said, you should do something about that. and it was something that we really encouraged a lot to kind of test the momentum in our focus groups. And there'd come an acceptance and a recognition that whilst previous generations hadn't had that and they'd got by, that it was time that people could start to see their daughters, you know, that it was compromising their careers and their ability to get ahead. So, you know, the opportunity to see Julia Gillard's government introduce paid parental leave, you know, and also partner pay, and actually encouraging partners to and particular fathers to take up roles in the home. We know that that leads to greater equality in households once they're involved in those early stages of the child's life. And obviously we've seen, you know, a raft of, you know, both at federal level and state level, in terms of whether it's the NDIS, whether it's greater equal opportunity legislation, you you know, Leonie is much more well versed in this. I'm
abortion
going to
law reform.
Yeah, abortion law reform.
Abortion law reform.
Sure. Yeah,
well, I actually wasn't going to talk about a policy. I was going to talk about the role models that women in Parliament are. I mean, I've done a lot of good work with Claire with women in Asia and Pacific, and part of that work is one of the types of work is a mentoring program where Myanmar women MPs were paired with Australian women MPs, one of whom was Claire, and Timor-Leste women MPs similarly. And as part of the program, those MPs from Myanmar, where we now, you know, there's been a coup, the military in power, the fantastic MPs are on the borders, activating towards changing, getting rid of the military. But then they were few of the people in the parliament were women. In Timor-Leste, a few more. They have a quota, so they have a third of people that are elected have to be women. However, they don't have any of the powerful positions, any of the leadership positions, so while they're there, they're not leaders. They're not made leaders within their parties. So these women come to Australia and they look at our parliaments. And when they come to Australia, we're always shocked because the parliaments badly behave in Australia. And I've been to the Myanmar parliament, I've been to the Timor-Leste parliament, there's nothing like the behaviour of the Australian parliaments. So we go into the parliament with the women, the Vic parliament, we went to the federal parliament, then we went down to the Vic parliament, we go into Victorian parliament with the women from Myanmar, very little women they are, they're very small people, in the parliament, into our parliament, and it's just shocking. Everyone's yelling at everyone in the Victorian parliament. And it was a time when, like now, there were issues to do with resources. And Lily D'Ambrosio is the minister. And Lily's one of our original Emily's List supporting MPs, still incredibly supportive of Emily's List. And Lily has to keep getting up and she has to have the Libs and the Nationals yelling at her and screaming at her and tell her, just sit down. And Lily just keeps talking and she keeps talking about how important it is about making sure that power's available. And the women from the Myanmar women just look in the parliament, and the woman I'm with and I are going, oh, look, this is just terrible. What are they seeing? They're seeing this awful thing. So we walk out of the parliament, we say to the women from Myanmar, we're really sorry. Our parliament's just so badly behaved. And they go, no, we saw this woman, this little woman like us, who got up and she stood up to those men who were yelling at her and screaming at her. And she just kept talking. And we said, yeah. And they said, she's just fantastic. We just want to be like her. And I just thought, that's why we need more women in our parliaments. Yeah. Not only can those women be role models for women in Australia, they can be role models for women around the world. So that's what a difference having women in parliament makes.
Nothing excuses the behaviour in the parliament.
I
was shocked when these women were saying that, and I just kept my mouth shut because one of my pet things is the appalling behaviour in some elements of the parliament. But we only see a snapshot.
Yeah.
Most of the time in the parliament, it's not like that. It's when I think it's something to do with cameras. They actually come on board and question time is just, and they ask you all the time in parliament, what would you change? I'd kill question time. Because it's a waste of everyone's time. Anyway, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have lied, but it's just what I have school kids coming through, looking at how Parliament operates, and they go away. They go away shocked that behaviour that would get them into trouble at school is allowed in our Parliament, and then they think that's how they've got to act. So when you go to the school model parliaments, you have all these young people who think the yelling, the screaming, the finger-pointing, the personal abuse is how it should be. And you've got to then rewind that and say, no, you don't have to do that. But back to the question, the process, look, I think it's the thing a couple of people have talked about, just seeing yourself in a job gives you confidence that that's a job you could do. And when you go into parliamentary areas and those wonderful libraries that are there and you see the photographs around the walls, and in trade unions as well, and for generations, if there was a woman there, it was an oddity or it was someone taking minutes, you know. And I think one of the importance is to get that figure so that it's natural, so that anyone can be in parliament. and that it needs to reflect your community. The parliament should reflect the community because it's clearly nothing about us without us. So when we're looking at policy, you need people who have lived experience or people who have access to lived experience, that they can feel as though they will be heard. And for me, the Senate actually allowed more of that interaction because of the nature of our committee system. Because the committees bring people together from across parties with a particular focus. And when you look at the community affairs, where I did a lot of my work, it's the area that does health, education, equality, our society. And so consistently we would have committees working together, and because it was the Sheila's committee, as I heard it said a number of times, we had women from across the parties, and I think that's such a key issue. If you're going to effectively change policy and make a difference, you need people across the political spectrum, and you need to try and find those partnerships, not with the natural suspects. And when I think of some of the committees that we were involved in and the policy changes that came out of it, it was because people could learn together and see what they agreed on and look at the best of that to promote it into policy. That's where the NDIS came from.
Or the RU486.
That RU486 came from that, where women across different parties just said, this is wrong. You know, this shouldn't be how we operate. We're better than that. And then we went out and we got numbers within our own areas and worked together. That would not have happened. In not one single party did we have the numbers to get that up. And people told us we were mad. They told us to stop, you know. And what happened was there was such strength there and such community of interest. I mean, I know at the time people were hopeful that that would lead to a flood of this activity. But what inevitably happened was a pushback. When the women were successful in putting in such a significant change, it was like, you know, you don't do that again.
Mm.
You don't do that again. You play by the rules. Mm. And I think we've really got to rebuild that ability. And I think you have great opportunities. One of my favourite experiences, and not for all the right reasons because it was horrific, was working with people who've been in institutions and also women who had had their babies stolen by a system that determined who was a fit mother and who wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I use that as an example quite deliberately because the reason that came into a committee was the dedicated, painful commitment of women who were the victims of that policy. And they never gave up. They lobbied and lobbied for over 20 years before they got those series of committees up at the state and federal level. And out of that came an extraordinary Senate committee, which exposed the horror that is now being exposed in other countries. Australia was a leader in exposing that because these women found women in the parliaments who would pick up the issue, and it was women who picked up those issues. Men came on board because we had people who'd been affected by adoption, people who had been separated because they were too young, their parents didn't support it, that they lost their children. And I think that was an area where you saw women in the community affecting the views and considerations of women in the parliament, which led to the committee, which led to the awareness, which led to the extraordinary acknowledgement of the suffering and different programs around Australia that responds to it. Victoria was extraordinary in that space, and you now have up in one of the parks near Parliament House a beautiful sculpture which commemorates the women and their children who were affected by that policy. So, I mean, that's what we can do. You can affect change and you can give support to each other.
Thank you, Claire. That's absolutely amazing. And thank you for all the hard work you did whilst you were in the Senate. We are very grateful for all that hard work you did.
Yeah.
Now, we are getting towards the end of our time. So what I'm going to do is get you in 30 seconds to tell me what the key steps you think are important to get yourself in a position to get elected. And I'll start with you, Claire.
Get your team. Get the people around you. Learn from others and support others. And then they can give you the technical stuff about getting in the right spot, getting the training, you know, knowing the numbers. Because as Joan always said, numbers, and that's what you have to have.
I think work out what you want to change.
think about why you want to go into Parliament. You're not going there to keep a seat warm. You're going there, as we've talked about today, to make change. So think about your values. Start to elaborate on them. Talk to people about them, and that's how you get elected.
What they said. Do your own work and build up your own relationships and networks, and don't be reliant on the patronage of others, particularly men, because otherwise you'll be beholden on that going forward. So it's really important to have your own relationships and your own networks, and make sure, you know, that you put effort into whether it's policy committees that are your passion, building up a vibrant branch, or, you know, getting involved in the party in other ways.
That's fantastic. Thank you, guys. Now, we did promise that our audience would be able to ask any questions, so I'm going to quickly throw out, are there any questions that anyone... Yes, Lucy.
Thanks, first, everyone, for a really amazing panel, and thanks to all really kind words from me, and to much really grateful for your encouragement. My question is following on from your observation about... observing that late nights are an unavoidable part of being a politician, and that is something we all, I'm sure, understand. But it seems it's also an unavoidable part of being a political staffer, from what I understand.
Yeah.
And this is a real issue, I think, because it essentially excludes so many women from not only running for office, but being involved in that really important capacity as well, which has to have an influence on the kinds of policies that are actually developed and implemented by governments, when people who are primary caregivers for children are simply locked out of those workplaces for a really significant chunk of their career, and indeed probably forever, if you haven't gotten there by the time you're, say, 45, 50, there's a good chance you're not going to get there at all, very regrettably. So my question is, how can we address that? I mean, of course, there is the option for some fortunate people of getting money to help the garden children, others can rely on family networks, but those aren't very viable for everybody, so something else you can do.
Well, really important to look at family-friendly hours for Parliament, I think. And I know that in Victoria we've looked at those. I don't think that's happened federally.
It has, dude, in some ways. Federally, they changed the ridiculous system in the Senate estimates being you're only really tough if you sat all night. And the Senate estimates, they did bring in that they have to finish at 11. It's still not meeting it. But that came out a lot of, and that was people across the parties and across genders saying, this is stupid. You don't make your best decisions when you're, you know, tired or exhausted or angry or hungry. You know, those things, it all affects you. So they've done that, and I think many state parliaments have played around with it. But it's wider than that. It needs using other networks to get it, because it's very hard to look at a way where you can change too many hours. Well, one of the problems is that Parliament doesn't sit enough. I think that's a problem in every state and federally. They don't sit enough, and it's almost a game as to how you can reduce the number of hours they sit. But I think we've got to work out ways where we can get people's skills and knowledge involved, and that's where the innovation comes in. We haven't got it right yet, but I think we can do that.
And federally, they're not doing school holidays now.
Yes,
they're moving to...
And the other fabulous thing federally, and not yet in Victoria, is the childcare centre. The childcare centre at Parliament House. The childcare centre at Parliament House in Canberra makes such a difference, even as well as the parliamentarians and staffers being able to see those little kids, you know, and see people dropping off their children. Just makes such a difference. It changes the way the whole thing works. So we really need that. We did look at that. Was that when you were in... We were looking at a childcare centre for the Victorian Parliament. People thought it was, you know, gave parliamentarians too much advantage. You know, they'd be advantaged as opposed to other people, so it wasn't supported. But I see that, you know, gyms and things like that are always often a part of Parliament, so childcare centres are really important as well.
I often wonder, saying that I would never have been able to do an advice job if I hadn't done it before kids. Because that's a big barrier. I think the Victorian Parliament's changing of sitting hours now to kind of stop at 6, I think probably makes that much more feasible now. And obviously it shouldn't be something that's dependent on, you know, each individual office, you know, and that leadership is from the minister and that chief of staff, but that's my understanding that it really depends on that now. Obviously, COVID has also changed that in terms of working from home and that greater flexibility. So it'll really depend on how much of that culture kind of stays for that flexibility to happen. But there does need to be a wholesale leadership around that rather than being dependent on individual minister offices.
Yeah. Yes.
When I was in the 90s, and I come out of a bad marriage, and I had three little kids, but I hated Jeff Emmett.
So when you were talking, you've got to be motivated. I was motivated. But when Parliament was here talking about family friendly hours, and the Liberals always used to say, yeah, he's supposed to be into family friendly hours. For me, I was a rural woman. Mm. So, as a rural, and I'm a person who goes to bed early, so it was hard. But as a rural woman, I didn't want to sit more days because that was more days for my kids. So you can't be too generic about this stuff. If you're working, you know, hundreds of kilometres from home, you don't want to finish at six. You want to keep going and sit less days. So there has to be an awareness that different people have different needs, even if you are a mum with small kids. It's all right for, you know, people who live in the town and communicate with the dinner, but it's different for different people. But being motivated, that's, yeah, if you're motivated, you'll find a way. And your kids won't suffer. I had three little boys, and I used to worry about it, but, you know, later on they said, nah, you know, you were good, you were good, you know, they'll thank you for it, and they won't curse you. Oh, that's awesome. They're very resilient, I think, kids. Just check out mine in the corner over there. do we have any other questions? Ah, yes, up the back.
Yep, thank you, great event. And then we're looking at you from all of you. You all seem highly principled women. And I'm wondering how you keep going in a system and a party or a system that often you would need to, wouldn't align with your values and ethics, and you'd have to decide when to compromise and when to walk away, and how to, and when to decide to keep aligned with the party or the system or whatever that doesn't necessarily, how do you keep going?
Sometimes it's by day, it really is. And I think a number of phrases have come out this afternoon. You've got to be committed, you know, you've got to know why you're there, and you actually have to know the system and work within the system. And I was really fortunate because I often was troubled by things that happened, and I had great support within the caucus that if I was worried about something, shadow ministers and ministers for the very brief time we were in government when I was elected, would take the time, you know, if you ask the questions, to sit down and work them through. Because often it's, you don't know the whole story, you need to work it through. Labor has been affected over the last few years with areas of policy which have lost us many members. And a lot of them were my friends. A lot of them were the people that supported me. And it's no surprise, the refugee policy is one that's in the climate policies. They're things that people have been questioning. But I think that I've said before that you find your team and your work, and we actually have a group that had views about refugees and continue to do so. And we thought that it was better to stay in and work within the party to try and change our policies, to work to ensure that there was that voice in our party. So that is hard, and I spend still now talking with members of the party and ex-members of the party, sometimes at polling booths when we're handing out. And, you know, you just keep what's important to you and try and work conference after conference after conference to amend our policies and to have speakers publicly taking up issues and doing it within the party. And to me, the Labor core values are still so important that I feel part of Labor, but I still think there are times when you really have to work hard to stay in. It can hurt.
Yeah. So. I've been a member of the Labor Party for a long time, and originally I was quite involved in the Labor Party, and I was on the Women's Policy Committee, and then I stopped being so involved, and now I'm not as involved. I'm more involved. I put all my passion and my energy into Emily's List, and there I knew I'd be surrounded by people that agreed with me, who were supporting the principles that I agreed with. So I'm not the best person to answer this question, but what the MPs do say, the women MPs say, you've got to have your girl gang, who you can always debrief with, who'll always support you, who'll always be there for you. So you do need, as Claire said, have your supporters around you. But for me, I was never able to do that because the Labor Party disillusioned me on a number of occasions. But I'm still a member, but not active at all. I'm putting all my energy and passion to Emily's List.
I think for me, it's about Labor will always be the more progressive of the two parties that are going to form government. And so I see my role in the party is to try to make it better and to work inside the tent. Mm. And that takes a lot of effort and frustration. And I think the only way you keep going is if there's more wins and benefits and gains than there are losses. So, you know, I too have been disappointed, particularly as someone who's worked in the refugee policy area, for example, as to the direction the Labor takes. Ultimately, I'm much more pragmatic and about my politics. And so what I've kind of seen and learnt over time is that it's fine to sometimes take the high moral ground, but that can be really lonely and ineffective in terms of achieving change. And for me, if there's more wins than gains, then that is for me the ultimate end goal in terms of, and slowly chipping away, you know, and we see how far we've become, and now have the advantage of a federal and a state Labor government and being able to implement change that makes life better for people will ultimately overshadow and, you know, and it helps you get through the disappointments. So it's more wins than gains, ultimately.
And
yeah.
We see that. See, and when you do get a winner and you see a policy change in the party and it makes you really proud, that moment of joy is so great.
Yeah.
Mm. I couldn't agree more. So if there's no other questions, I do apologise, we are a little bit over time, but I think it was totally worth it. It's been absolutely fantastic hearing what these amazing panellists have had to share with us today. So if I can get you all to thank our panellists.